Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back. And we are live here. I have a very special guest today, Will Coley. Are you ready there?
How are you? All right.
Welcome. How's it going?
I'm good. We're working on getting some stuff together, getting ready for a move.
Awesome. I shouldn't say awesome. I know that's always like a nightmare.
I
absolutely hate doing it.
This is a nightmare on top of a nightmare.
Yeah. Man, so let's kind of I just want to introduce you a little bit and kind of give some of your background. Let's start there. I'm trying to think where do we start with this. So you're Muslim and you said you converted. You weren't raised Muslim, but you converted a few years ago. And also you're a libertarian, right? So I guess kind of give me a short history of, you know, how were you raised and how did you come about this and, you know, how did you end up where you are now?
Well, I grew up in a really conservative, East Tennessee, you know, upbringing. My parents were Republican arm pullers, you know, so like, if Mao ran and won the nomination for the GOP, they'd vote for Mao, you know.
Yeah.
Whoever's name is next to the R, that's the number they're punching. But they were mostly because they were Ross Perot supporters as well when he ran for office because they were big fiscal conservatives. I grew up in an area where we were taught how the federal government came in and seized farms from families from the turn of the century all the way to the 70s. You know, I grew up with the skeletons of literal physical skeletons of eminent domain and things like that. Come, you know, the old silos coming out of the lakes where I lived. And I had a Pentecostal upbringing, very, very conservative Pentecostal upbringing. And so I guess that, those two things really kind of informed my worldview, so to speak. I was a theology nerd most of my life. So when most kids were in the back of the classroom reading Heavy Metal magazine in eighth grade, instead of paying attention in class, I was reading a copy of the Tao Te Ching.
Nice.
You know? I love to, or the Four Noble Truths, or the Satanic Bible, or, you know, if it was religious and I could get my hands on it, I read it. It was just how I've just always been kind of a nerd for that kind of stuff. You know, some people learn JavaScript and Swift, and I read and collected obscure old religious texts.
Interesting. So that's so it seems to me from my experience anyway, people who do that, who kind of read a lot about a lot of different religions, they usually tend to lean atheist because they're like, okay, well, they can't all be right, so that means they must all be wrong, and they kind of get into that camp. So did you kind of go through at least a phase in that?
No, really. I went through a non-acknowledgement phase where I wasn't religious. I wasn't an atheist. I just didn't really acknowledge that there was anything outside of my drug-induced stupor and party. You know, like, I worked in a nightclub, you know, as a DJ for 6 years in Florida. So, you know, while I was doing that, I just kind of ignored the fact that I was into religious things. And then somewhere in my mid-20s, around 26, I guess, I just started studying again. I picked up a copy of the Kibra Nagast, which is a text of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church and the Church of Rastafarianism. And I started studying like the life of Leonard Thomas Howell, studying Ethiopian Orthodox Christianity, African versions of Christianity, and through that stumbled into Islam. And it was like reading what I'd always been taught and believed my whole life, like the ultra importance of family. Like, the Bible says honor your father and mother. The Islam says for you to carry your mother and wipe her butt and feed her when she's 80 is not piety. It's not righteousness. It's simply you paying them back for what they did for you, and that they deserve more than that. And it explicitly states it. There is no vagueness about, like, you know, honor your father and mother is kind of vague, whereas the Islamic prescription is very direct. The idea of not breaking bloodship bonds. And I come from the kind of family, my wife even kind of comments on the fact that we could slit each other's throats and then go have dinner with each other 3 days later and it'd be water under the bridge. Because that's just like, that's family.
That's family, yeah.
Yeah, it's family, you know. And a lot of families aren't like that anymore, but mine is. Like, there is no, I had a sister that literally robbed everybody in the family blind. But she was at the family reunion 2 weeks later. You know, like, it's just the way things. And Islam says that's what you're supposed to do. Even when your family are the people that you'd rather not be around, you still you go out of your way to make an excuse for them, to keep them in your life, even if you have to keep them at arm's reach. The charity, the importance of community. It was just all these things that I'd always believed my whole life. And without the Trinity and things like that, you know. So it's all the prophets that I grew up with, all the messengers that I grew up with, Jesus, Moses, Abraham, all of these things. But instead of it being Paul who's saying, well, I know Jesus said these things, but we should do these things over here. I'm Paul. Listen to me. It was, you know, Pauline Christianity just didn't make sense to me. That's why I walked away from it. And this did, you know, this made more sense to me. It was a religion that said that reason and logic were important. You know, when the scientists among the Muslims figured out that the earth revolved around the sun, they didn't try to burn them at the stake. Like, they, you know, like the Inquisition was wanting to do with Galileo, you know.
Right.
And the knowledge, learning, it's anti-intellectual. It's a tradition that says specifically that God is not pleased with the people who refuse to use their intellect. It's like a special gift God gave humanity. And if you would rather just be uninformed and favor superstition, then God sees you as ignorant and as something that's blameworthy. And all of those things kind of just spoke to me. And then at the same time, when I first became Muslim, the guy that taught the Arabic class was a Ron Paul fan. Back in the beginning, like 2007, you know?
Wow.
So they encouraged me to study Islamic jurisprudence. So I start studying, and I get I don't remember if it wasn't The Road to Serfdom. What's the one on economics, on monetary policy?
Oh, man. I'm bad with names, so I probably read it and forgot the title.
Ron Paul's book on monetary policy. So I'm reading Islamic economics while I'm reading this book about Ron Paul from Ron Paul about Ron Paul's monetary policies, and I'm noticing that the correlations in economic views are insane. Like they're just like it's like reading the same book, just two of them.
Interesting.
And so I decided at that point that I wanted to see how far down that rabbit hole would go. So I started digging and started studying more, and I found things like that the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, did not set up a state. He didn't have a state by modern definitions. There was no monopoly on the right to use force. So like after the battle of Hudaybiyah, I believe, Uhud. After the battle of Uhud, there were some Jews during the battle who had opened the back gate of the city so that the enemy could come in the city. And that it's a story that's often used as like, well, the Prophet Muhammad didn't like Jews. No, that's not true. The Jewish community arrested those guys for opening the back gate and put them on trial and sentenced them to death for treason because they opened the city gates to an enemy army to assist them in overrunning the city. And then the magistrates of the Prophet carried out the sentence. But it wasn't Muhammad who put out that sentence. It was the Jewish tribal leaders. So there was no monopoly on force. The Jews had their own courts, their own leadership, their own culture, their own markets. The Christians had their own courts, their own magistrates, their own markets, their own leaderships. The Muslims had theirs. The pagans had theirs. And what they had in Medina was each group had a contract with the other one of mutual non-aggression and mutual defense. So none of us, I won't punch you in the face, you don't hit me in the face. But if somebody outside the city hits either one of us, we'll defend each other. And if you and I have a dispute, we'll find a person from one of the other groups to arbitrate between us. So like if a Jew and a Christian have an argument with each other, you'd get a Muslim or a pagan to arbitrate between them. That way it was fair.
Interesting. So this is all really interesting because this kind of, you know, we get these questions all the time. Well, in a libertarian society where you don't have, you know, some centralized government, how do you resolve disputes? And it sounds like these actually are a lot of those proposed solutions. So
Sharia is actually built to be able to function without a state. The court system itself is supposed to be totally separate from any political leadership. The political leaders don't appoint the judges. They don't pay the judges. They can't influence the judges. The state doesn't write legislation. So the judges are supposed to be independent of the state completely. And you even have, if you look in Baghdad and in northern Africa, after the collapse of the first Umayyad dynasty, so we're talking like 900s, after that empire collapsed, those locals, they decided to replace the government with nothing. And there's an interesting book by a historian named Patricia Crone. It's called Ninth Century Muslim Anarchists. And it talks about in Baghdad and all across North Africa, when the empire collapsed, those local people were like, okay, so we got rid of cancer, let's be cancer-free. Instead of, let's replace it with lymphoma.
Right. You know? Right.
Let's get some chlamydia. No, they were like, let's just be healthy. So, and it existed that way for almost 1,000 years until the invasion of the Christians in the Crusades. And unfortunately, that kind of proves the statist's view on like when a bigger idiot shows up. So, like, you had all of these groups that were independent of one another without a state. There's no overarching state. There's no army. And then you have, like, to date, the largest military force to ever show up in a single place. Just show up and be like, so we're here to kill everybody.
Right.
And the Muslims weren't ready for it. They weren't. They didn't have stand. They lived in, at the time, they were pretty much in peace. You know, they weren't worrying about foreign invaders and things like that. So when the Crusader mob, because it wasn't even really an army the first time, you know, it was villagers and it was all branches of society. It wasn't just knights on horseback. It was hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of peasants who were just looking for, you know, salvation and fortune, you know, in the Holy Land. And they weren't prepared for that. And that was the end of it. After that, you had Al-Ghazali. And Al-Ghazali made an argument in favor, basically against logic, against the use of reason, and that religion, rather than being based on reason as it had been up till then, that religion should be based on tradition, and that blind adherence to tradition is more important than reason. And shortly after that, he wrote The Incoherence of the Philosopher. And then shortly after that, Ibn Rushd, or Averroes, Averroes, wrote The Incoherence of the Incoherence. And unfortunately, what happened is that the Muslim world rejected The Incoherence of the Incoherence. Because The Incoherence of the Incoherence argued that no, blind adherence to tradition is not healthy, and it's not the right way to practice the religion. And the Muslims said, no, we prefer blind adherence to our traditions, because they were being invaded by a Western force. So to them, maintaining the tradition, the cultural traditions, became a paramount importance, because there was an outside culture. It's like now. Like the rabid populist nationalism that you see now among Trump, white Trump supporters. They feel like what's right and what's wrong, what their religions teach them, none of that matters. What matters is we have to defend white Western culture,
right,
at all costs. You know, throw reason and logic out the window.
So this is interesting, because there's and I'm getting a lot of interesting questions in the comments, and I'll try to get to some of these. But so there's this divide. Like, so a lot of people are worried about Islamic terrorists and extremists, and a lot of people in some groups think that this is, you know, anybody who follows any version of Islam is ultimately, secretly, some ticking time bomb of extremism that's you know, just waiting to go off. But it sounds like you're telling a part of history where basically a thought of logic was proposed, and some portion of the Islamic society rejected that, and they wanted to stick to more traditional things. Is that kind of, is there like a big divide in that?
Not anymore, because the Muslim community by and large sided with Al-Ghazali over Ibn Rushd. Al-Ghazali was the one who was like, philosophy, logicians, these kinds of things, this is not good for religion. That basically the reason why the Crusaders had won was because we had decided tradition wasn't as important, you know, because the religion had viewed reason and logic, scientific exploration, all of these things as a great thing up until the Crusades. And then during the Crusades, there was this switch, and it was because those things were condemned by arguably one of the biggest Islamic scholars in history. And when he wrote his book, The Incoherence of the Philosophers, and at the time, philosopher wasn't just what we think of as philosopher. The Tuhawafat would be not just would be like Aristotle, you know, or Socrates, because their main thing was built around logic. You know, Aristotelian thought is built around, you know, questioning. And Ghazali disapproved and condemned Aristotelian ethics and Aristotelian logic. And Ibn Rushd didn't. Ibn Rushd, as a matter of fact, one of the interesting things about Ibn Rushd is that St. Thomas Aquinas was a member of the school of Averroes, and that's the Latinization of Ibn Rushd, is Averroes. Averroes's commentary on Aristotle was required reading in all the first universities in Europe. If you wanted to study Aristotelian thought, then you read the commentary of Averroes, who is Ibn Rushd. You know, I mean, they Latinized the name so that people wouldn't realize they were reading Muslim authors.
Right.
You know,
so what
you have St. Thomas Aquinas's Just War Theory. If you read St. Thomas Aquinas's Just War Theory, it is Islamic military jurisprudence, almost word for word, the whole concept. If you read the bibliographies of St. Thomas Aquinas, Ghazal, that's Al-Ghazali, and Averroes is Ibn Rushd. So you have St. Thomas Aquinas citing both of those scholars in his bibliographies of his writings.
Interesting.
And, you know, Aquinas is arguably one of the cornerstones of modern Western values and thought.
So now I want to ask this because I'm typically of the thought that if somebody says something that's a good, interesting thought, like don't do harm to other people, whoever says it is not necessarily relevant, because whoever says it, they might not be 100% pure, perfect, you know, angel of a person. You know, there have been so many influential thinkers that I've listened to, from Stefan Molyneux to Martin Luther King and all these other people, and even Martin Luther King and Gandhi, and you know, they have faults in their history. Like, you know, there's
Gandhi was super racist.
Yeah, he was into incest or something, or he was a pedophile, and all these other interesting things that are, and so if you look at it, it's like, okay, Gandhi, he might have done some really amazing things, and those things, and he might have come up with some amazing ideas, and those are great ideas that we should carry on into the future. But that doesn't mean you should put every single person with a great idea on a pedestal, because they're not perfect all around. So,
yeah.
Would you say the same about Islam? As you know, it sounds like there are some really interesting things. It also sounds like there's a lot of history, and because it's philosophical, it changes. So something that might have been part of Islam in the past is not necessarily relevant anymore. Is that kind of...
Well, it's even more finely detailed than that. The Islam of Saudi Arabia is not the Islam of Syria.
Okay.
The Islam in Syria is not the Islam you're going to find in Senegal. And the Islam you find in Senegal is not the Islam that you're going to find in Malaysia. Who was it? Ibn Abbas, or was it?
So it's kind of like the splintering of Christianity, where you have different schools of Christianity that have.
Well, Islam is meant for the culture to influence the religion. So I think Ibn Abbas was the one who said it, was that Islam is like water, and the society which it's poured into gives it its color. So the Islam that you pour into a Malaysian vessel will have a different tint to it than the Islam that comes from a vessel from Mauritania or Morocco. You know, the people themselves and the local cultures actually add to the religion itself. So you see, here's a really good example. It's a really simple example. Zabiha meat, right, which is often called halal meat. You don't really see Arabs do it really religiously. But you do see Indians and Pakistanis are super strict about only eating meat from halal grocery stores. So the reason is the Arabs, everybody that lives in Arab countries is either Muslim, Christian, or Jewish. And Muslims are allowed to eat the meat that is slaughtered and prepared by Christians and Jews. They're called Ahl Kitab, the peoples of the book. Right? But you can't eat meat that's been killed or prepared by pagans. So the Arabs aren't really strict about it because everyone that lived around them were Christians. So when they come to America, America's a Christian country in their views. It's the West, so it's Christian. So the assumption is that the companies are Christian and the companies are run by Christians and the slaughterhouses are run by Christians. So you can eat that meat because Ahl Kitab, people of the book. Whereas a Pakistani or an Indian won't do that because they live and grew up in India and Pakistan. And what are they surrounded with there? Buddhists, Jainists, Hindus. They're all polytheists.
Okay.
So they had to be really careful where they bought their meat in their homeland. So when they come to America, they won't eat meat from Walmart or from the local grocery store. They will only buy meat from Muslim butchers. So that's that right there is just a simple kind of snapshot of the way the religion kind of changes a little bit depending on the culture that it's in. I mean, there are bigger changes besides that. Like if you went to Indonesia during the what's called the Maulidul Nabi, it's the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. You will see parties in the streets of dancing and singing and drum play, and it's amazing. If you did those things in Kuwait, you'd get lashed. You'd be arrested.
Interesting.
In Kuwait, it's blasphemy, basically.
And these are all based on and so both of these cultures are based on the same religion, which has the same religious text backing it.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's interesting. So
one thing that happened as Islam moved from the Arab lands toward the east, you saw Sufism emerge, and the concept of divine love. Of loving God for the sake of loving God, not because you're afraid of going to hell, not because you want to go to heaven, but simply because God deserves your love. And the whole concept of divine love, and that came into being as Islam started to spread in areas where Buddhism was very, very prevalent. And you literally saw the religion slowly start to take new shape as it spread to the east from the Arab land. And it, just to look at that history and watch the change. So like in the beginning of the Umayyad dynasty, right, you've got all these wars. Muawiyah and his progeny are constantly military expansion, right? They're kicking in doors, they're taking over churches, they're kicking the Christians out of their houses of worship. I mean, it's the kind of stuff that's the stereotype, right? But then, early 900s, now this Buddhist influence is starting to come in, and you have Al-Hasan al-Basri, who was the teacher of the very first Sufi saint. But he wasn't a Sufi, but he was the teacher of the first Sufi saint. And the political leader, Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, one of the final Umayyad emperors, comes to him and he says, look, man, I don't like the fact that the prophet and his first successors allow the Christians and the Jews and the pagans to continue to do the stuff that we condemn. And he specifically lists pork, raising and consuming pork, fermenting and consuming alcohol, and marrying close relatives. Because in the Christians, among the royalty and the aristocracy, they would marry brothers and sisters and first cousins and stuff like that. So Umar ibn Abdulaziz is like, look, you know, I don't like that this is going on. I don't like that the Prophet left it this way, and I want to know what I can do. And al-Hasan al-Basri responded, this is the way things are. They pay for the state's protection because the non-Muslims paid for protection from outside physical invaders like the Romans. And you won't change this to something that you prefer. He didn't give him a suggestion like, no, you know, just leave it. Everything's fine. You really should. No. He was very direct. This is the way our religion teaches, and you will not change it just because you want to or you don't like it. So he was very clear that what the non-Muslims do basically is none of our business.
Interesting. So there's a question, there's a lot of questions coming in, but I thought this one was pretty interesting because this is kind of relative to what I think a lot of people's fears are about Islam. So the question was, what is the penalty under Sharia for leaving Islam?
There isn't one.
What did Muhammad say about leaving Islam?
There isn't one. As a matter of fact, the Prophet, the Quran speaks of those who leave Islam and then come back and then leave Islam and then come back and then leave Islam again and then come back. So, I mean, basically, there is a hadith tradition that was used to create legislated law during a specific time during the Muslim dynasties. And the hadith says that Ali, this is all supposed to have happened after Muhammad died, that, who was it? Ikrimah Abdul Ibn Abbas. So this is Ikrimah, the servant of Ibn Abbas. Told a man that he saw Ali ibn Abu Talib say of a group of apostates to kill them as the Prophet instructed by burning them alive. Now, there's a few problems with that. The first problem is that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam forbade using fire as a form of punishment for anything at all, and that there's a special place in hell for people who do use it. You can't even burn an anthill. There's the first problem. The second problem is that there are five different versions of that hadith, and one of those versions, Ali hears that this has been said about him and says, woe unto Ibn Abbas, because this is something that's not true that's been said about him. The other problem is the narrator, Ikrimah Abdul Ibn Abbas. Ikrimah is only in Bukhari, and he's only in Bukhari with this specific hadith as a single narrator. He's not listed in any other hadith tradition as a single narrator because he was a known liar. As a matter of fact, there are hadith about the son of Ibn Abbas having him tied to a post in front of his house waiting for the magistrate to come because he was narrating fake hadith and attributing them to Ibn Abbas. So you have basically a law that was written based on something that was a rumor that came from a known liar. So during the Turkish Reformation in the 19th and 20th centuries, there was a book that was formulated called the Majel. And what the Majel tried to do was to go through and find these laws that were based on spurious hadith. And that's the reason why you don't see those laws in the Majel, is because they figured out that they were based on spurious, inauthentic narrations.
So this kind of sounds like it's getting into the realm of like different interpretations of.
No, it's not about an interpretation. It's about hadith traditions are very specific in the validity of them, because hadith aren't the Quran. Hadith are so-and-so says that he heard so-and-so say that so-and-so said that so-and-so said that so-and-so said that they heard Muhammad or someone connected to him say or do. So we're talking like 8 generations removed, passed down oral traditions that were eventually written down. They have different levels of validity, different levels of authenticity. And one of the things that automatically throws a hadith out is if it's attributed to someone who is known to be a liar. And what you had was you have different, like Imam Ash-Shatibi, who was a contemporary of Bukhari, said that there were transmissions, there were hadith that were in Bukhari's book that had he been there when Bukhari was writing the book, they would not be in the book. You have numerous scholars of hadith who do not take narrations from Ikrimah Abdul ibn Abbas because he's a known liar. And so basically you have it's not an interpretation. It's a lie. It's a person who was known to lie, telling a lie, and that lie being written down, and then a government later going, ooh, we can use that, because that's what governments do.
Right.
You know, they saw something that they could take advantage of. They had what today they call scholars for dollars. They're the state employed religious leaders, so to speak. The Prophet Muhammad said that the worst of scholars sits at the doors of kings. And that the greatest of kings sits at the doors of the scholars. So you kind of understand that metaphor. These are bought men. These are men that, you know, their job is to find a way to justify what the state is doing using the religion. To find a way to justify strengthening the state using the religion.
And we see that with the Constitution. I mean, we see people saying, no, you can't do that because the Constitution says you can't. And then others are saying, oh, but wait, right here, it says that we can do something. And you know,
it's the natural progression of humanity. The Prophet Muhammad is actually reported to have said right before he died that the first thing of Islam that would disappear from the earth was polity, was the political aspect, the proper governance, so to speak. He said that it would be gone within 30 years of his death. That just and proper Islamic governance would no longer exist within 30 years of his death. That was what Muhammad said. And sure enough, if you look at the timeline, the Rashidun, who are considered the four, what they call the rightly guided imams, Ali ibn Abu Talib was murdered about 30 or almost 30 years to the day after the death of the Prophet Muhammad.
Wow.
And Ali ibn Abu Talib is seen as the end of that. It was the end of the Rashidun and the beginning of the first Muslim empire.
Interesting.
So exactly what Muhammad said would happen is what happened. Within 30 years of him dying, the legitimate Islamic leadership no longer existed.
Interesting. So I want to kind of change directions here for a minute, because I know you made a post I don't know, maybe it was a couple weeks ago now, that I thought was really interesting, and we kind of got into a discussion on it then. But you said that, so under Islam, it's I don't want to say it's illegal, but you're not supposed to borrow money or deal with credit. And so you made the claim that
you can't borrow money on interest. You can't consume or pay interest.
Okay. And a lot of religions have that. They call it usury. Sometimes they say it's high interest. Sometimes they say it's interest at all. But based on this, you made the claim that a system of like a credit bureau basically is discriminatory against Islam because members of Islam or followers of Islam would not be able to have any credit history based on that, because you're not supposed to be borrowing at interest. And so my objection to that was, okay, but if you're not supposed to borrow money at interest, why would you need a credit report except for, you know, there's things like rent or, you know, things that aren't necessarily credit, like a cell phone, things like that. So we kind of got into that discussion a little bit, but I want to hear kind of more your take on why that's discriminatory.
Well, basically what I've and it's because I'm going through right now in the process of moving. I have spent hundreds of dollars on applications. And the first thing that any of these places do is they check your credit report. And if I pay my electric bill on time, that doesn't go on my credit report. If I pay my rent on time, that doesn't go on my credit report. If I miss, that does go on my credit report.
Yeah. So,
and I've even been told by Muslim banks that they won't do business with me until I've had a credit card. Because
that's interesting.
I know. Because they use the same LIBOR-based credit rating system for their lending of money that's not lent at interest, as the interest-based banks do. But the way that the system is built, so I go to Five Palms Properties, right? And there's a nice property. I've got plenty of income. I've got all the necessary money. I'm even willing to pay an extra month in advance.
I've tried that one before.
Fill out the applications, right? Show them my bank statements. Here's what I've got in the bank. Here's all of my income. I'm well over the necessary income. I've had two landlords in 9 years. Both of them will give me a glowing reference. None of my references ever even get called. They check. They see that my credit score is N/A. That's my credit score. I don't have a number. It's N/A.
So how do you...
And because I don't have a number... They never even call my references. They don't care if I pay my bills on time. I don't have a credit score. And they are required, because of their the business model, that I have a credit score of at least X. And then I explain to them, like, look, I've never had a credit card before. My wife's got a college degree. We didn't take out any student loans. We've got two vehicles. We've never taken out a car loan. Please. We've never taken out a car loan. That's just not how we do things. Mm-hmm. And they don't care. We want to see that credit score. But I don't have one. Well, then why don't you call my references? Because you don't have a credit score. So it doesn't matter that I pay my bills. It doesn't matter that the rental guy that, you know, the man who I rented a house from for 7 years has nothing bad to say about me. Has nothing bad to say about how I took care of the property, has nothing bad to say about whether or not I'm on time with the rent. They never get that far. They check the credit score first and then send me a letter in the mail and an email that says you've been rejected because of your credit score. And then when I call them and I explain to them, they don't care. It's no credit score equals no place to live.
So that sounds like one of these, like is this like a big like apartment complex with a management company, or I mean
everybody,
everybody. Like small mom and pop landlords, single property,
everybody now.
Wow.
Yeah, if you're not willing to put like $5,000 or $6,000 down for a buy here, pay here type rent to own thing, where your interest rate's like ridiculously high and you're paying $99,000 for a house that's really technically only worth about $35,000, you know, unless you're willing to go through that, you don't have an option. There is no option. I've had, like, you just call the guy on the phone. He says, yes, it's my house. I'm renting the house. I require a credit score of at least 600. And then I say, well, I don't have a credit score, and here's why. Oh, well, I require a credit score of at least 600. I was like, can you at least call my references? Because my references will tell you that I'm a good tenant. I require a credit score of at least 600. So it's even private people. The credit score has now become – it even can keep you from getting a job. I have a friend of mine that works at Amazon. He says that – they had three guys come in for the job. One of them he had worked with before. They hired the guy who had the best credit score.
Oh, wow.
He's basically taking up space. They didn't hire the guy that he had worked with before. He's like, this guy never stops. He's got the best work ethic you'll ever see of anybody, but he has a bad credit score. He had a house foreclosure during the crash. So now his credit score is jacked up.
Wow.
So instead of hiring the guy that's a hard worker because he had a bad credit score, they hired the guy with a good credit score who's basically a mouth-breathing waste of space.
Man.
And the credit Amazon decided who they were going to hire based on a credit score. Because the credit score now is the ultimate I had a lady tell me when I had one lady ask me how long I've been a drug addict.
Where'd that come from?
Because if you don't have a good credit score, then only people who are hooked on drugs don't have good credit scores.
So, I'm still trying to wrap my head. So okay, wait. So like if they run your credit, which in order for them to do that, they need a social security number, which I totally hate that concept in the first place. Like why?
Yes.
Why do we have to have serial numbers? But it's, I'm still trying to get my head around this. So how could you like not have, like, I'm trying to think the first time I got approached, like, you know, as soon as I turned 18, I started getting letters from credit cards and they were like, yeah, fill out this form and we'll give you a credit card. And I did. And they gave me a credit card. And I know this was a completely different time, but I'm trying to think, was there ever a point where I had actually no credit score versus I would think if you just in having a social security number, you would have some like whatever the baseline 500 or something.
I've never owned a credit card. I have never bought a car on credit. I've never bought anything on credit.
So would it be the
same thing? My wife as an immigrant, she's never bought anything on credit and she has no credit score. I have no evictions, nothing like that. It's not that my credit score is like, my credit score isn't zero. My credit score is NA.
So would you like, because this has become a problem for you and I don't want to suggest this because, I'm going to suggest this, but I don't want to suggest this because you should be a good citizen and you should be a part of the system that I hate. But I just want to ask if this would be an option for you to, because the system is there and because the system is a pain in the ass as a way around it. What about something like a secured credit card that appears on your credit report as if it were a regular credit card, but it's not borrowing at interest because it's, well, no, I guess that is technically... Technically, it's an interest account.
you have to sign a contract that states that you will agree to do business with interest should you get in a position that you spend money that's
right.
Not there.
Should you not pay the should you not pay at the end of the month? So really that has nothing to do with being secured or not.
The way that works, the Quran in the Quran, God only declared war on one sin. Wasn't murder, wasn't theft, wasn't adultery, it wasn't blasphemy, it was interest-based lending. One sin God declares war on. And God says that all are equal. The one who pays, the one who lends, the one who borrows, and the witness to the contract are all equally sinful.
So this is okay. This is like really interesting because I know, like, you know, some of the early financial systems were in the Middle East. What? I guess let me ask this. Like around the time when that idea, when that punishment for interest-based lending was created, do you know like what the environment was that
You had rich tribal leaders who were using interest-based lending literally to put people into slavery. They would loan someone money at exorbitant interest rates, and when they couldn't pay it back because of the exorbitant interest rate, they literally would lose their families, their wives, their children, or themselves to slavery.
Similar to what's going on today, either individuals to banks or even the government to this $25 trillion debt that's going on.
Yeah, exactly. So it's seen as predatory by nature. The whole concept of interest is seen as a way for the haves to maintain their position and oppress the have-nots, to make sure that the have-nots can never rise to their station, because they're always in the hole and can never get out. You know, like those 17 and 20% interest rates that poor people get, you know.
29%.
So that they always stay poor.
Right.
You know, the buy here, pay here, drive time auto, you know, where you get a $4,000, it's a car that's $4,000 Blue Book, but they sell it to you for $7,000. And then they finance it at the 20% interest rate. You end up paying $11,000 for a car that's only worth $4,000.
Yep.
And now you're in the hole up to your neck. You can never sell that car and get out from and under it because you'll always be upside down. And by the time you're not upside down, the car will be worth $1,000 or $500. You know, like,
right.
It won't even be worth selling by that point. And
so
that's the whole thought process.
Yeah, and those places have so many different scams. Like even without interest, there's one that, you know, they sell a car that they know is a lemon on payments, knowing that at some point you're not going to make the payments because the car's going to stop working. So then they go and repossess it, and then they do just enough repairs to get it running again and sell it to someone else, knowing it's going to break again in a couple months. And so meanwhile, they get all the extra payments, and they're reselling the same car over and over.
They're ruining people's lives.
Yeah.
But once that gets put on that person's credit report, they're never going to be – it's going to be 7 years before they're going to be able to rent a house again, to get another vehicle, to anything, to even get married to a person who's a foreigner, you know?
What does that have to do with anything?
You didn't know your income and your credit report were directly connected to your ability to sponsor a spouse who's an immigrant?
No.
Yeah. So me and my wife got married, and we applied for her citizenship. And by the time all the paperwork and stuff finally was to the point where we could start moving forward, we'd been married long enough that we already had two kids. Because, you know, immigration is the slowest thing on earth.
Right.
So since we already had two kids, that meant I had to make $65,000 a year and have no debt to be able for her to stay in the U.S. Or I had to find a co-sponsor who would co-sponsor her and put up something as collateral along with their own incomes. So my sister and her husband co-sponsored my wife so that my wife could stay. And their house was the collateral.
This is just in case
she needed welfare before she got her citizenship.
Oh, it's collateral against welfare.
Yeah.
Wow. So, this is like blowing my mind right now, because I'm like, what the fuck would you possibly put collateral up for against welfare?
Yeah, so if my wife ended up needing food stamps, my sister and her husband agreed that they would pay the state for any food stamps that my wife got if she ended up needing welfare before her citizenship.
And if they couldn't pay the state, and if your wife insisted on getting the food stamps, then they'd take
my sister's property, yes.
That is insane. And how many food stamps would her property buy, I wonder? They'd probably say about a month's worth, right?
That's paid back.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's... Ugh. I hate it. I hate having conversations like this because, like, I'm... What's that?
We had two kids, so according to the government... I needed a $63,000 a year salary with no debt. So if I didn't make $63,000 a year with no debt and I couldn't find a co-sponsor, they would have physically come to our home and kidnapped my wife and sent her back to her country with, while she was breastfeeding a baby. Wow. And it didn't matter if we were legally married.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Because
you have to go through even if you're legally married.
So we're coming up on time for the show, but there's something else that you said. I want to hear about this a little bit before we go. So you said that there are Muslim banks who lend money, but they won't lend unless you have a credit history. But
yeah,
do they lend at interest? I mean.
No. It's called Muharraba banking, and what I call it is interest, and what most of my sheikhs call it is backdoor riba, which basically – okay, so here's what they do. You go to the bank, and you say, hey, bank, I want to buy this house. And the bank says, okay. So you apply with the bank to buy the house. Now the bank goes, and the bank – buys the house. Say it's a $150,000 house, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the bank sells you the house for $300,000. No interest.
I see. So they're still making a profit. It's just...
It's still interest.
Yeah, it's just not... I mean, I guess... Because, there are loans that do... what is it? Okay, so there's like they call it an origination fee, right? So they tell you, oh, we're giving you a low interest rate, but then they charge an origination fee, which is basically like, you know, it could be an extra $1,000 or $1,500 or you know, depending on what you're buying. If it's a house, it could be $3,000 to $5,000. Sometimes they call it a closing fee or whatever. That's extra money that, like, so the bank is going to make, you know, some amount of profit. And they can either tell you, okay, we're going to give you one interest rate plus a closing cost, or they can just get rid of the closing cost and give you a higher interest rate. But, of course, it sounds better to give you a lower interest rate. That's all into their profit. So that's really interesting. But at the same time, so the difference with interest is obviously if you fall behind on your payments, then the interest keeps accruing on a higher amount and it keeps growing. Is that maybe why they consider...
No, because they have late payments. If you don't pay your late thing penalties on time, then you get charged a late payment, and that late payment gets bigger every week that they're not paid.
Oh, wow. So it really does... It really does add exactly up, like, interest.
Same way rates are set using LIBOR, the same exact thing that the banks use.
It's just a loophole.
It's not even a loophole. If you hear the scholars talk, the scholars will tell you, like, this is BS. Like, I know they're telling you that it's not what it is, but it totally is exactly that.
Wow.
Yeah, and but the Saudi government and all the big wig Saudi state employed scholars, they're like, no, we invented this. This is the new thing. It's perfectly permissible. But then, you know, like the independent scholars who don't live in Saudi Arabia and don't have to worry about the religious police kicking their doors in if they speak out against the state are going, no. This is nonsense. Imran Hussein is a great source on that subject. He's a scholar that I studied with in Malaysia about 2010, 2011. And I have all of his books, except for his newest one. And he talks about the Islamic banking and Islamic economics, Islamic monetary policy. Sounds like Austrian school, man. It really does.
So what would be the normal system that would be allowable to buy a house? Would it just be to save up all the money and pay cash?
Well, no, you had banks back then that simply, if you defaulted on the loan, then the bank gets the house and it sells the house. That's how the banks would make their profits, was the people who defaulted, they would get the property back, and then they would resell the property.
And
that's where the profits would come from. They weren't charging interest. With businesses, what they would do is loans wouldn't be loans. They would be treated as investments. So you would, instead of loaning me $30,000 to start a new business, you would invest $30,000 in my company.
For like a share of ownership kind of thing?
Exactly. And then you would have you would get paid back, and then you'd have like a set dividend for a certain amount of time. But the problem with that is if the business goes under, your $30,000 is gone. But that's the risk. And that's part of the issue with Islam, is that Islam is very against profits that basically are created out of nothing without risk. That there needs to be some type of a risk involved. Right. And interest-based lending, it's just profit on top of profit on top of profit for the sake of more profit. And there's very little risk because of the interest. And so you get the property and you get the interest. Like, you just keep making – like, it's just money for the more money.
Right.
And it's predatory to Islam. It's predatory as well, because it's basically the ultra-rich using their wealth as a way to prey upon the poor. So that the poor never ever really get out of where they are, can never challenge the wealthy on even footing.
Wow. That's all. I mean, this whole thing has been really eye-opening, because, I mean, honestly, you know.
Again, these are rules that were made at a time when an interest-based loan that you couldn't pay back could literally cost you your life or the lives of your children into slavery. Right. Literal slavery, like servitude slavery. Not the like debt slavery, you know, not what we think of when we think of like debt slavery.
Right, like, shit, I gotta get a job, I have to keep working so I can pay off this debt.
No. This is
literal.
You don't
like,
have a
you're gonna live in a cage, you're gonna live on this property, you're gonna yeah.
You are property.
Yeah, that's – wow.
Yeah, and that's the atmosphere that these rules were made in, you know, these religious rules were made. And I don't see a whole lot of difference because of our credit system now, we're in a position where we have a choice of either joining the system or possibly not being able to sustain ourselves, not being able to find a home for my children.
Right.
The Prophet Muhammad actually said that would happen, that there would be a time that two things would happen. One, that the dust of riba would be on everything, that there literally wouldn't be a way to live without coming into contact with something of interest in one way or the other. And all of our money is built based on interest. So every dollar that's in your pocket has an interest rate attached to it.
Yeah, and there's this, I mean, the whole system is set up to coerce us into participating at some point. Like, if you don't have a Social Security number, you're screwed out of just about everything. You have to have a passport if you want to be able to travel different places in the world. And in order to have that, you have to declare an association with a certain, like, sponsoring government to you know, which obligates you to all sorts of things. So it's they basically say you're not free unless you participate in all these programs that we say you have to participate in. And once you're in those, then they just pressure you into all kinds of other, they just keep pushing you deeper into that rabbit hole.
One of the companions actually asked for a little clarification of that statement. And the Prophet Muhammad says, it's like a man who stands next to a fire and then leaves. And when you come into contact with him in the marketplace, he smells like smoke, but he has no soot on him. You get what I'm saying? So, like, it's there even though you don't even see it. You don't even notice it. Like, it's that subtle. And he said, the Prophet ﷺ said that at that time, that adhering to Islam, that being Muslim, would be more difficult than to hold on to a hot coal from a fire, to just stand there and hold it in your hand. That it would be more difficult than that to be able to be a Muslim and stay practicing simple orthodoxy, like don't consume interest.
Wow.
You know, that simple orthodoxies would be literally harder than holding on to hot coals. So, you know, this is something when someone's like, well, I mean, it's just the system as it is. You should just do it, brother. Well, no. To me, that excuse doesn't work, because our religion told us that this would happen, that there would one day be a time where there would be an oppressive system that said, if you don't contribute, if you don't partake, we will oppress you. We will prevent you from being able to eat. We will prevent you from being able to find shelter. We will go out of our way to make your life difficult if you won't become a part of this oppressive system. So we were told this would happen. So if you decide to go get that credit card, you know, that's between you and God, but don't tell me I should. You know what I'm saying? Like, don't be like, well, brother, don't worry about it. You know, I mean, that book was written 1,500 years ago. You know, we're Muslims now. Things are different. No, we were told.
Yeah, the laws of physics and the laws of mathematics haven't changed much.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? In all honesty, I don't think what is morally true has changed all that much. Don't hurt people. Don't steal their stuff. You know, like, that's not changed since the first, you know, man fell out of the first woman's butt. You know, like, the first woman squatted down and shat out the first baby. That's still not changed. You know, Cain killed Abel. You know what I'm saying? And it was wrong. He hit him over the head and he took his stuff. So the first sin was theft and murder. Don't hurt people. Don't take other people's stuff. It's been a moral truth since what most Western religious people view as the very first children that were ever on earth.
Yeah. Yeah. You and know? It's and there's, you know, a lot of, especially in Christians, and I don't want to knock Christianity, but a lot of them will support this government system, which thrives off of theft.
Oddly enough, it was the Protestants that actually opened the door to this. The Catholics were against usury. It was considered an oppressive, predatory practice, the way that Muslims see it. And then came the Dutch Protestants. And the Dutch Protestants were like, well, yeah, but we're not Catholic anymore. So all those rules we followed when we were Catholics, we don't have to follow those anymore. And they just declared that usury wasn't against the religion anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how interest-based banking even got into the West, was the Dutch Protestants just declared it so. They were like, we have decided that this is now permissible.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the religious world was like, who? By who? Huh? The people who were going to benefit from it, right?
Exactly.
Man, who else would change that law?
The Dutch state and the Dutch bankers said, oh, well, we can make money off this, so we should totally be allowed to do it.
Wow. All right, man. Well, it's been great talking with you. I know we're way over our time, and it sounds like you got some family to get to. But I want to thank you again for coming on the show. This has been really awesome, and I hope everyone learned some interesting stuff. And taxation is theft, and we'll talk again soon.
Yeah. Before we go, if you don't mind, if you guys like what you heard tonight and you want to, you're welcome to call our show. I'm on the air on 13 radio stations around the country, 4 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in on lrn.fm to our show. It's called The Cult of Freedom, where we discuss it's myself, a Christian evangelical, and a transgendered atheist. And we have very interesting and entertaining discussions about everything from philosophy to sociology to religion to language. And we also have an hour where we talk about gaming and crypto and blockchain technology as well. So
awesome. And I think you said a website, but website to go to for that?
If you want to listen to the show, the easiest way is at lrn.fm. We're on 4 to 7 Eastern Standard Time. You can also find the podcast. If you can't listen to the show live, you can listen to the podcast on Podbean.
Awesome. Sounds great. Well, again, thank you for coming on, and I'm gonna go check your show out. That sounds pretty awesome. Thank you very
much. Take care.
Awesome. I'll see you later.
All right, bye.
Taxation is
at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.